Well, good afternoon, listeners. This is the Dogs Program, the Australian Council for the Defence of Government Schools, and we're here every Saturday to promote and to defend public education. And we've got a bit of breaking news. This last week, one of us was at the VCAS to hear a wonderful program from the Year 12 students with their performances, and there was a teacher outside who gave them this very interesting piece of information. VCAS union members and industrial action. What's been happening between the state government and the union? Well, as we all know, the negotiations have broken down because the state government is just not paying our teachers enough. So, what's happening next? On Thursday, the 21st of May, VCAS AU members will be stopping work for the first half of the day. So VCAS union members are taking strike action and they will be rallying with other AU members from schools in the region outside the office of Labor MP Nick Stalkus in Bentley. So how can you help them? You can dress up in red on Thursday, the 21st of May, and that you can go to the Labor MP Nick Stalkus's office at 723 Centre Road, Bentley East, in the morning, around 9 o'clock. So if you've got a morning to spare and you want to support our teachers, you can go to 723 Centre Road, Bentley East, in your best red attire. And the teachers and the school staff who are going on strike are fighting for the improvements in pay and conditions, and they will be sacrificing their own wages on that day. Teachers, the union members down there, will be out there at Bentley fighting for public education, and we wish them all the very best. Now, we have an interesting press release for you, and it's press release 1068, and I'll leave you in the good hands of Dale and Andy.
Thanks, Jean. This is Dog's Press Release number 1068. Public cannot be subsumed under private. Integration of private into public is not the answer to the education question. In her new book, Rich Kid, Poor Kid, The Battle for Public Education, produced by Vintage Point for the Australian Institute, Jane Carrow walks through the decades of policy decisions by both coalition and Labor governments that have led to the current Byzantine funding system in Australian education, alongside increasing inequality and crumbling social cohesion. Interestingly, she notes that her mother, a fierce believer of public education, was a supporter of the New South Wales Dogs in the late 1960s. The book is well worth reading. Alongside the book, in an article in The Age on May the 3rd, 2026, an excerpt was printed as follows. Our kids are segregated in every way imaginable. We should look to Canada for a solution. We have given the chronically underfunded public system all the responsibilities and expect it to accept every child, including the most disadvantaged and so the most expensive to teach, while starving it of resources. We have given sometimes extravagantly overfunded private schools all the rights, including the right to isolate themselves from the toughest end of education. As a result, we now have one of the most segregated education systems in the OECD. In the decade to 2015, Australia had the second highest increase in concentration of disadvantaged students in disadvantaged schools, lagging only the Czech Republic. And we are continuing to use public funding to increase that segregation. For those kids in the so-called good schools, results have at best flatlined. For those in what are rapidly becoming residualized schools, results have plummeted. And we haven't just segregated our kids along class lines. We have sliced and diced them every way we can think of. We put girls with girls, boys with boys, though as I've suggested that might be changing a little bit, smart kids with smart kids with rich kids, poor kids with poor kids with Christian kids with Muslim kids, Jewish kids with Jewish kids, Catholic kids with... I'm not so sure most kids in Catholic schools are very Catholic anymore. Sporty kids with sporty kids, arty kids with arty kids, black kids with black kids, and white kids with white kids. Is this a good idea? Will it build a cohesive society? Does it help our kids to get to know one another and help break down prejudice? Or does it do the opposite? Her solution: an integrated system promoted by Tom Greenwell and Chris Bonner. She says, education researchers Tom Greenwell and Chris Bonner in their book Waiting for Gonski take this idea a step further. They suggest that all schools should be offered the chance of being publicly funded as long as they agree not to charge fees. They could keep their special character, usually religious, but would have to accept all children who wanted to attend within their area. Some private schools, especially high fee ones, might decide this was a bridge too far and decline the offer, in which case they would lose their public funding and be self-supporting. This would then release some badly needed dollars for schools struggling with high concentration of disadvantage. Greenwell and Bonner called this the Ontario solution, as that's what schools in the Canadian province have done. Chris Bonner told me about the shock the Catholic bishops of Ontario expressed when it was suggested that their schools could charge fees. They saw it as utterly antithetical to their religious mission. Maybe they should come and have a chat with the Catholic bishops in this country. In both the United Kingdom and New Zealand, the majority of religious schools are part of the public system. They do not charge fees, must accept all local kids who want to come, but may keep their religious character. The only problem with this suggestion is that the private schools will fight it, and that matters because they are exceptionally powerful lobbyists. They can have their cake and eat it now. They will probably fight to the death against any attempt to rebalance the scales. Trevor Cobold from Save Our Schools reacted this way. He wrote to The Age, but his letter was not published, so he put it up on the Save Our Schools website. Canada is no solution. The following letter was submitted to the editor of the Sydney Morning Herald in response to an opinion piece by author Jane Caro in the Sun Herald on the 3rd of May. The letter was not published. It is baffling that erstwhile advocates of public education want to jettison core principles that have governed public education for 150 years. Jane Caro's proposal to adopt Ontario's system of full taxpayer funding of private schools should be comprehensively rejected because it breaches the core principles of secular, non-discriminatory, and free education. It would introduce structural contradictions in the public system. Some schools would be secular and others free to propagate a religion. Some would be prohibited from discrimination in hiring staff, while others would be allowed to discriminate on the basis of gender, disability, sexual orientation, transgender identity, and marital status. Full taxpayer funding of private schools is no guarantee that they would not be able to charge fees. Other countries, such as Netherlands, Belgium, and New Zealand, which integrate Catholic schools in the public system, permit a plethora of fees, capital charges, and pseudo-fees in the form of so-called voluntary contributions. Catholic and independent schools had the chance to participate in a truly needs-based funding system designed by David Gonski. They squibbed it in favour of special funding deals. Generous government funding and fees provide Catholic schools with a significant resource advantage over public schools and a very large advantage in the case of independent schools. It is incomprehensible that they would give this up in the light of the Gonski experience. It is equally incomprehensible that the Catholic bishops and education leaders would give up the privilege of diverting government funding intended for regional and outer suburban disadvantaged schools to inner city schools competing for market share with wealthy independent schools. The direct way to reduce social segregation in schools is to stop the massive underfunding of public schools and ensure their full funding, as well as end the overfunding of private schools. Now I'll pass over to Andy for some more responses.
Thanks, Dale. On May the 11th, Tom Greenwell replied to Save Our Schools, and this was published on the Save Our Schools website. Tom Greenwell, co-author of Waiting for Gonski, has submitted the following comment on our post, Canada is No Solution. The comment is published in the interest of furthering public debate on an important issue in school funding in Australia. In Ontario, around 93% of students attend public schools. Two-thirds of these public schools are secular, while one-third are faith-based. But all are fully publicly funded and completely free, and all are required to enrol students from a local enrolment zone. The socioeconomic profile of the students in the faith-based schools is almost exactly the same as those in the secular schools. Social segregation is much lower in Ontario schools than in Australia's. The very small fee-charging private school sector serves around 7% of students and receives no public funding. Trevor Cobbold appears determined to defend the status quo in which Australian private schools receive huge public subsidies but can continue to charge fees as high as they wish, enrol and not enrol whoever they like, and expel whoever they want to. This is because he believes it would introduce a structural contradiction for some fully publicly funded schools to be religious and discriminate in hiring staff. This is an extraordinary position for someone who knows Australia's school system as well as Cobbold does. We already have a system where lavish public subsidies to religious schools often exceed the funding at comparable public schools, and these schools enjoy exemptions to the Sex Discrimination Act. How is that situation redressed in any way by allowing those schools to continue to charge fees? How is it improved by allowing them to enjoy significant resource advantages, public subsidy plus fees, which gives them a competitive advantage over public schools? The heart of the matter is how we dramatically reduce the intense social segregation in our school system. Cobbold says we must fully fund public schools and stop overfunding private schools. That's absolutely necessary, but nowhere near sufficient. Even if that happens sometime in the middle of next decade, and I'm not holding my breath, private schools will still enjoy net resource advantages through the combination of their SRS entitlement plus unregulated fees. As those resource advantages can attract the able and affluent, the unregulated fees and enrolment practices will continue to push the disadvantaged away. Money is important, but public funding must entail commensurate public obligations and regulations, and we can only make the demand that fees are prohibited if full public funding is there to replace it. Jean Eli from the Dogs responded on May the 11th. By all means, take over the full funding of private schools, but then just take them over and make them fully public schools. That is, public in purpose and outcome, above all, genuinely public in access without any enrolment requirements, public in ownership and control. Then they might be public in accountability. Our 19th century forefathers understood all this. You can't afford to be tolerant with the intolerant and compromise the public with the private good. I know public school supporters don't like to be called sectarian when they oppose public funding of private religious schools, but why be afraid of mere meaningless invective? Why indeed? And back to you, Jean.
Yes, well, that was a rather fun press release, or at least I found it so, because we got a phone call from Trevor Cobbold, who was rather amused at the response from the Dogs. But let's have a quick break, shall we?
You're listening to 3CR Community Radio, 855 AM. Visit the 3CR website at 3cr.org.au/podcast to hear the most recent recording from each show, or 3cr.org.au/streaming to listen live.
Well, we hope you're still listening to the Dogs program. In previous months, we've been very interested in the effect that AI is having on our classrooms. And it's mainly talked about by people in the tertiary sector at the moment, and since Sorrel is in the tertiary sector, I thought that you might be interested in what she has to say about it.
Thanks, Jean. This article is written by Micah Nathan for The Guardian and is entitled, "I Knew My Writing Students Were Using AI. Their Confessions Led to a Powerful Teaching Moment." I have been teaching fiction writing at MIT since 2017. Many of my students last wrote fiction in middle school, and very few have experienced a proper workshop. So at the start of every semester, I offer these directions for writer and reader alike. Read the story at least twice. Mark what works and what doesn't. Underline great sentences. Flag chunky syntax, gaps in logic, and unrealistic dialogue. Ask yourself, does the story work? Why or why not? What could improve it? answer in a signed letter to the author and attached to their story. Give your honest opinions. Remember that an effective peer review demands close reading of the text, accompanied by a boldness of spirit. As the directions foreshadow, most of the time we're discussing why we didn't like the story being workshopped, because writing a good story is immensely difficult, even under the best conditions, especially for STEM-centric undergrads who thrive within a structure of quantitative problems and solutions. Systems where there's a right answer and a clean method for arriving at it. Fiction writing isn't quantitative. Good writing feels good to read. Bad writing feels bad. An effective workshop is a paradox. Students must provide textual evidence to support the qualitative as if it were the quantitative. This is a terrifying prospect for the habitually superb student to sit in stony silence while their classmates and professor slash at their work. The act of confronting that terror is itself an education for the writer, because writing is both vehicle and vessel for thinking. Abstract made concrete, feelings translated into words. This is what many writers talk about when they refer to good prose as not just poetic expression, but communication. Thus, when we criticize a writer's work, not only are we criticizing their aesthetic choices, we're also criticizing, and here's where it can get personal, the writer's feelings and their ability to communicate them. It's a lot for the ego to absorb. Before a few years ago, the only way a fiction writer could protect their ego was to either pay someone else to write for them or resort to plagiarism. AI changed all that. AI's prose is perfectly mediocre, producing the sort of inert gloss that reads like a Frankensteinian amalgam of MFA workshopped writing, an unintentional parody of the style it mimics. The resultant stories and essays are simulacra of thought, generated via patterns, pattern recognition learned from millions of human-penned words, rooted in no particular experience by no particular person. AI writing reminds me of Tennyson's description of the beautiful Maud in the titular poem. Faultily faultless, icily regular, splendidly null, dead perfection, no more. Insightful readers feel that emptiness even if they can't articulate it. They sense that the body moves without a brain. By contrast, student-written fiction is gloriously flawed. A struggle on the page between what the author is trying to say and what's actually being said. The prose stumbles in a way reminiscent of a foal learning how to walk. Even in their trembling legs, I see hints of future grace. Such clumsiness is necessary. An absence would be proof of the foal never having learned to walk. Death and taxes. Technophobia is the third certainty. In 1565, nearly a century after Gutenberg invented the printing press, the Swiss scientist Conrad Gessner was already worrying about the confusing and harmful abundance of books. An 1899 article in Nature claimed the telephone was the most dangerous of all inventions, because it enters into every dwelling. Its interminable network of wires is a perpetual menace to life and property. Now we've added AI to the list of worries. A 2025 MIT Media Lab preliminary study found that participants who used ChatGPT to write essays showed lower neural connectivity than those who wrote without assistance. Other studies warn of similar dangers. From the not yet peer-reviewed reports with self-explanatory titles such as AI assistance reduces persistence and hurts independent performance, and generative artificial intelligence reliance and executive function attenuation, behavioral evidence of cognitive offload in high-use adults. Dire stuff if proven true. But whatever the peer-reviewed findings may be, the central warning is hard to ignore and doesn't really require a study for validation. Letting students routinely and thoughtlessly use AI, we're weakening their minds. That warning shaped how I addressed AI in my syllabus, specifically how I planned to discourage its use. Playing the AI detection game drags me into a surveillance mindset that undermines the workshop environment. If you use AI, it reveals your orientation toward writing. Do you want to make art or just turn in text? Do you want to actually learn how to write or just pretend to do so? I was certain my questions would shame them into compliance, even without an explicit prohibition. So at the start of last semester, when I read two of my students' stories for the first workshop and knew within their opening paragraphs that both stories were written by AI, I was hurt. I was also worried because I realized that for the first time as a writing professor, I had to deal with students producing words without work, which wasn't quite plagiarism and wasn't quite paying for someone else to do the job, but it felt like kind of a naive chicanery, a perversion of the contract between writer and reader. Writing isn't just the production of sentences. It's the training of endurance by way of sustained attention. As the first workshop started that night, I turned to the ostensible authors and told them I knew that AI wrote their stories. I didn't need AI detection software to know, I just knew. The prose was too polished for a young writer, the arc too tidy, every character pre-packaged, every metaphor a pastiche without context. I told the class the workshop couldn't proceed because I won't give feedback to an author who doesn't exist, but I assured the would-be authors that they weren't in trouble. MIT's policies regarding AI usage were in flux, and my syllabus offered an opening. Besides, had AI been available during my undergrad years, would I have resisted its help? Of course not. The pedagogical borderlands have always been filled with students questing for shortcuts. The technology changes, but the quest remains. For a few moments, all was quiet except the classroom's ticking radiators. Then a teary-eyed confession. One of the ostensible authors said she only used AI because she was scared of looking stupid or being criticized for bad writing. She said she loved writing stories and hated having used AI, but she couldn't stop herself, recounting a sequence similar to an addict's descent. At first, she fed her story into AI for a grammar check. It suggested line edits and she accepted. Then it asked if she wanted structural edits. Then it offered to rewrite the entire piece. The other would-be author admitted he had never written a short story before and he had an idea but didn't know where to start. I asked him why didn't he reach out to me for help. He shrugged. One of the other students raised her hand, saying she didn't understand why it was bad for AI to write stories as long as the stories are based on their ideas. More students spoke. One wanted to know how using AI was any different from using a human editor. Another wanted me to answer why, at the university that launched one of the world's first AI research programs in 1959, were we even having this debate? Isn't AI meant to make everyone's life easier, less stressful? Isn't the point of AI to free humans from the tedium of rote tasks? The conversation that followed their confessions was one of the most productive teaching moments of my 8 years at MIT. Writing, I told them, isn't supposed to be easy. And of course it can be tedious, but that doesn't make it rote. Writing isn't just the production of sentences. It's the training of endurance by way of sustained attention. It's a way of learning what one thinks by attempting to say it. An LLM can reproduce the appearance of that activity, but it can't replace it, because the value lies not only in the object produced, but in the transformation that occurs during its making. In George Orwell's 1946 essay, Confessions of a Book Reviewer, Orwell describes himself surrounded by unread books, constantly inventing reactions towards books about which one has no spontaneous feelings whatever. High volume, on deadline reviewing, he argues, does not merely deform the work of reading, it deforms the self. The mindless manufacture of responses erodes judgment and standards collapse. Orwell is describing what happens when language is produced under conditions that disconnect it from thought. The reviewer performs the shape of a response without having actually responded. What Orwell couldn't have anticipated is that this condition would eventually be outsourced upstream. When a workshop fills with AI-generated fiction, every writer and reader becomes the reviewer Orwell describes. Orwell ends his essay by arguing that criticism would be healthier if it were slower, more selective, and less industrial. The same argument now applies to writing fiction. AI speeds the writing process, but isn't at all selective, and, in an ironic cycle, turns the act of creation into the kind of rote task it's meant to automate. Going forward, my policy is now plainly stated. I don't want students using AI to write their work. I want their words. I want access to their thinking, their voice, their struggles to find what they want to say and the best way to say it. I want to see what happens when someone tries to move through language without an intermediary finishing the thought. This is a pedagogical position, not a moral or technical one. The workshop only works if there's a writer in the room, someone whose thinking is visible on the page and who can speak directly to that thinking. Using AI to write not only nullifies the entire peer review concept, we're here to workshop each other, not to workshop AI slop. It also guarantees a weakening of the muscles needed to wrestle with writing. The danger isn't that AI will replace writers or render the workshop obsolete. It's that students are becoming accustomed to bypassing the friction that once revealed their process. Since that night, our workshops have changed in ways I didn't anticipate. We talk more openly about frustration, about the moments when a draft resists its own author. I still teach craft, form, structure, revision, but find myself returning to the tension between thought and language, the stories where abstraction refuses to take shape. We discuss why their thinking matters, and that their struggle to translate thoughts into words isn't evidence of failure, but a sign of growth. Even when, and especially when, words fail, what my students and I now guard isn't a boundary against machines, so much more as a sanctuary for authorship. A place where everything on the page, and not yet on the page, belongs to an actual person. Back over to you, Jean.
Well, thank you very much, Sorrel. And now we're going overseas with Jeff, and he's been doing a lot of work on how the students in other countries are reacting to their situation. Over to you, Jeff.
Good afternoon, listeners. We continue to struggle with the delicate subject of education and politics. They're very difficult to separate, especially public education. And as we look at what's happening around the world right now, some fairly large trends are emerging. I talked last week about what was happening in Russia and in Canada about militarizing schools. Now, I haven't sought to continue this stream of thought, but in looking at the countries, I was thinking about including this week's talk. I thought I would check out how things were going in Italy. And this article comes from the People's Dispatch, which I've checked out the media bias factor on this, and it's hard left. So this is from a hard left-wing Marxist-Leninist paper from Italy, reporting in English. This look, I include all this information so that you can take everything with a grain of salt. However, this is basically fact-based rather than ideologically based material. So I just like you to contextualize these articles so that you understand where they're coming from, because the dogs don't really take political sides. We talk mainly about education. But what's happening in education in terms of militarism does seem to be a trend worldwide at the moment. So this article came from May 7th from Anna Vracha. Now, this is, as I say, an international left-wing paper. And it begins, the name of the article is "Students and Teachers in Italy Strike Against Right-Wing Reforms and Militarisation." And the article begins, "Students and teachers across Italy mobilised to protest industry-friendly reforms and militarisation planned by the Meloni government. Students and teachers in over 60 localities across Italy striked on May 7 to protest education reforms presented by the Meloni government that seek to subordinate the education sector to industry interests and militarisation. The measures include aligning technical and professional courses with employer needs and removing critical content from curricula while keeping thousands of education workers in precarious positions. The day of mobilisation was preceded by an additional sectoral strike day on May 6th and coincided with a new wave of dock workers' protests for better working conditions against arms transfers and against arms transfers. Collective actions were launched by student groups and trade unions, including Cambiare Rotta, OSA, and the education bands of Grassroots Union Sindicale di Base, USB. We're striking against the militarisation of schools and societies, against compulsory military service, against the reform of technical and vocational schools that hands over the education of the working class directly to corporations, against the new guidelines for high schools, and against the contract renewal that offers shameful wages while inflation rises, driven by the costs of wars we do not want and did not want and do not want," USB wrote ahead of mobilisation. "Planned changes to education programs reduce the general education for students in technical and vocational schools who are predominantly working class. Instead, reform focuses their education on employer priorities. Meanwhile, the government also intends to adapt programs in high schools, Lycée, by, amongst other things, minimising content of critical European colonialism, imperialism and other concepts that encourage critical thinking. High schools attended largely by the upper and middle class are instead geared towards fostering a sense of identity that is explicitly Eurocentric and nationalist," USB added. "This is a school system that segregates, creates hierarchies and trains the children of working class families for precarious work while preparing the children of elite for a civilising mission that serves the rhetoric of war. Teachers' rights are also under threat as the sector already relies on precarious workers after decades of underinvestment and cuts with no stabilisation in sight. Trade unions and student groups insist that these setbacks are interconnected and prioritise the interests of the wealthy over popular demands, making it crucial for different groups in the sector to stand together. USB Scuola and OSA assert that their alliance is a strategic choice, not just a symbolic gesture," wrote USB and OSA branches in Potenza. "The unity between school workers and students is the strength of our project because the school system is rife with the same contradictions that plague society as a whole: exploitation, precariousness, militarisation and subordination to capital. As part of the international student campaign against conscription, we did not enlist. The strike has also emphasised the importance of resisting the reintroduction of mandatory military service in the region, with actions in other countries, notably Germany, to follow Friday, May 8th. The entire public school system is being geared towards the logic of war that pervades the world. Students are expected to acquire the skills and strategies needed to become an army for a labour market that's increasingly primed for war," USB added on May 7. "We must also strike against conscription. Students are not cannon fodder. They are not disposable workforce. And they are not merely resources to be exploited for the war economy. Finally, students and teachers emphasise the internationalist character of their struggle, linking wars fueled by the US globally with increased pressures on European students and workers. Cambiari, Rotter and OSA highlighted the presence of the US Secretary of State Marco Rubio in Italy as evidence of ongoing collaboration of European governments in illegal aggressions and war crimes. Marco Rubio's visit to Italy has sparked outrage amongst some students who are calling for his expulsion, the group said. This international criminal accomplice to the genocide in Gaza and being responsible for the war in the Middle East is also a key figure in the campaign against Cuba, which is at risk of being attacked by the US. Hundreds of Cuban flags are waving in the squares in support of and in defence of the revolution, sovereignty and peace in Cuba, the most solitary island in the world, and a cry of protest rises against Rubio. That's the end of the article. And I point out that there's also an international campaign of misinformation put out by the Soviet Union, the Russians, and they have been actively promoting hard right, well, and messages of trying to divide Europe and NATO and reduce NATO's ability to respond to their aggressive moves, especially in Ukraine. So this is all very linked. Many of these situations occur worldwide, and these similar sort of messages are being felt all over the world, and a lot of different organisations are putting out basically Russian propaganda. So take all this with a grain of salt. I'm just reporting what these papers are saying. Now we're going to go to Germany, and keeping this theme, because I just happened to punch in Germany and what was happening in education, and this is the same story, basically. This is from The Guardian, though. This is also May the 7th. By the way, Italy is paying a large strike for similar reasons on May 20th, by the way. Now, May 7th, this is an article by Kate Connolly in Berlin, and she's a correspondent for The Guardian. It's more than 50,000 pupils expected to strike over German rearmament policy. And it's a very similar theme, and you've got to feel that there's a international coordination coming from somewhere in Eastern Europe, I think. Anyway, but I will report this anyway. More than 50,000 pupils expected to strike over German rearmament policy. Organisers of nationwide protests say its aim is to stop the government turning young Germans into cannon fodder. Tens of thousands of pupils across Germany are expected to boycott the classroom and take to the streets in a nationwide protest organisers say is to stop the government's rearmament policy, turning young people into cannon fodder. Despite threats from teachers' associations and education ministries, which have said anyone who demonstrates during school hours could risk penalties and even expulsion, organisers say they expect the number of participants at Friday's school strike to be at least as high as the estimated 50,000 who attended each of the first two. The government and industry are preparing for war, and we, the young, are supposed to become cannon fodder. Neither have we been consulted, Hannes Kramer, the main spokesperson for the movement, Schulstreik gegen Wehrpflicht, which means school strike against conscription, told The Guardian. The protest reflects the unrest felt in homes and classrooms across Germany, Kramer said, since Friedrich Merz's governments brought the hotly contested changes to military service policy, arguing the country needed to boost its defences amid growing threats from Russia after its full-scale invasion of Ukraine. Under the Military Service Modernisation Act, mandatory questionnaires are being sent to all 18-year-olds to assess their willingness and suitability for military service. From next year, compulsory medical tests will be introduced. The law also includes a clause which, according to which men aged between 17 and 45 will, in theory, be allowed to travel abroad for longer than 3 months only if they receive permission from the armed forces. The legislation passed in December stops short of allowing for conscription, but the Defence Minister, Boris Pistorius, has said that it's still on the table if new policy fails to pull in enough recruits. According to the experts, the professional military needs to expand by about 80,000 members to 260,000 over the next 10 years, and it's reservist by 140,000 to 200,000 within a similar time frame. The third school boycott in 5 months has been deliberately timetabled to coincide with the anniversary of the end of the Second World War and victory over Nazi Germany, amid warnings from the organisers that Germany's deliberate rebuilding of its military strength is in danger of putting it on the path of no return to conflict. VE Day on 8th of May 1945 was the day that German fascism was defeated in Europe, said Kramer 21, a student of educational science at the University of Göttingen. We use this date to make clear the consequence of war and what consequences of rampant militarisation can be. Currently, almost half of the federal budget is being spent on tanks, bombs and infrastructure to prepare for the country for war, he said, adding that then, as now, big German companies, arms factories and as well as banks stand to gain. We are very afraid that we have not learned the lessons from our history. Unnerved not only by Russia, but the changed transatlantic relationship with Donald Trump in the White House. The German government has said it plans to put 779 billion euros into defence from now on until the end of the decade, roughly doubling spending for the previous 5 years. That would put the country on track to exceed NATO spending targets of 3.5% GDP by 2030. Merz has cast the rearmament drive as essential for Germany's and Europe's long-term security, telling MPs in his first speech to the Bundestag as Chancellor that properly funded German military was what our friends and partners expect from us. More than that, they demand it. If you want peace, prepare for war, has become his government's mantra. But Kramer said the act of rearmament itself could end up propelling Germany into conflict. Even now, the situation is different and Germany is now not now under a fascist regime. We feel the parallels in the rhetoric of German ambitions towards global influence and power through the military might, he said, framing the country's current militarisation and preparation for war as defence, as Merz does with his repeated claims that Germany is one of the biggest economies in the world, needs to become a global power in this is frightening, awful and very dangerous. At the last demonstration in March, pupils protested across about 150 towns and cities carrying banners with slogans such as "The rich want war, the youth want a future." Others carried posters declaring "Dying is not on the timetable." Friedrich Merz to the front. "Our only war is the class war, education instead of army physicals." Across the country, demonstrators repeatedly highlighted what they said was a jarring contrast between Germany's multi-billion euro rearmament and the underfunded education system. In Koblenz, one person held up a poster asking, "Why should I fight for a country that's not even capable of fighting for us young people?" Kramer, a member of the Socialist German Workers' Youth, SDAJ, said their movement had grown out of the collective feeling among pupils that their self-determination was being diminished. He said the creeping knowledge that they might be forced into a war was part of a series of crises that young people have faced in recent years, studying before the pandemic, that have shown them that they are being ignored by politicians. Schools are falling apart. Even in this, one of the richest countries in the world, there is a shortage of teachers. The worsening housing situation means many are forced to live with their parents, and young people's concerns about the climate have long been ignored. While the government was not yet obliging anyone to sign up, Kramer said he believed it was only a matter of time. I believe in the future it will be hard to refuse to serve. That's the end of the article. So we are seeing a massive trend, especially in Europe, where fear of the Russians is, to be frank, understandable. And of course, kids do not want to sign up for the military and they're protesting about it. But there seems to be coordination because these movements are happening simultaneously in several countries in Europe at the same time. I'm not going to take a stance on this. I think fear of the Russians is fairly rational. But I also think kids need to be allowed to be kids, and public education should be supported much, much more than it is now. And educated population is probably the best defence a country can have anyway. Look, I'm sorry it's such a serious topic. I'll try and make next week lighter. Apart from that, I'll send you back to the Dogs headquarters and wish you well for the weekend. Have a nice one. Cheer up.
Well, thank you so much, Jeff, for all the work that you do for us. But let's have a nice break, shall we?
Help us stay radical. Become a regular donor to 3CR. A regular donor is someone who loves 3CR so much that they set up an automatic donation to 3CR on the same day every month. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together, we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au.
Well, we hope that you're still listening to the Dogs program because we've got good news stories now. First of all, we're going to New South Wales and the New South Wales Teachers Federation. Every year they give a Peace Prize. This year they have given it to a lady who went to school in country New South Wales and ended up being one of the lawyers who supported Julian Assange. And let's hear about her, shall we?
Thanks, Jean. Sydney Peace Prize recipient shares her public education story. The recipient of the Sydney Peace Foundation's 2026 Sydney Peace Prize has encouraged public education students to think big about their futures. Human rights lawyer Jennifer Robinson will be awarded the Sydney Peace Prize for her commitment to international law and her dedication to upholding and promoting human rights, including free speech, press freedom, and gender and climate justice. She will receive the prize at a lecture and an award ceremony on the 12th of November at Sydney Town Hall. This recognition comes at a time when the international rule of law and human rights are under attack, Ms. Robinson said. International peace and security are under threat, not just from wars and war crimes, but also because of the climate crisis. In honouring me, you are also honouring the courageous clients and causes I've had the privilege to represent, individuals and movements who speak truth to power, challenge injustice, defend human rights, and demand action on climate. I hope this recognition will encourage them to continue and encourage others to join in this effort. I also hope this recognition will inspire young women from our public education system and from rural and regional areas like where I came from about what's possible for them, because you can't be what you can't see, she added. Jennifer Robinson is an Australian human rights lawyer and barrister. Robinson is best known for her role as a long-standing member of the legal team defending Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. She has also provided legal assistance to activists from West Papua. Robinson grew up in Berry, New South Wales, and attended Bomaderry High School. She then attended the Australian National University, where she graduated with a double degree in law and Asian studies, specialising in international law, Indonesian and Southeast Asia. She was awarded the University Medal in Law and was a distinguished scholar in Asian Studies. She was a Rhodes Scholar at the University of Oxford and graduated with a Bachelor of Civil Law with distinction and a Master of Philosophy in Public International Law. From 2009, her practice was largely media defence, freedom of information, and free speech litigation. She also provided international human rights advice, including on humanitarian issues in post-conflict Iraq. She's engaged in strategic free speech litigation before the UK Supreme Court and the European Court of Human Rights. She's also challenged obscenity convictions in Indonesia. She worked with Jeffrey Robinson when he was hired by Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens and Sam Harris in 2009 on establishing the legal case that the Pope and the Vatican were responsible for a crime against humanity as a result of the widespread child sex abuse within the Catholic Church. She gave a TED talk entitled Courage is Contagious about human rights and the political situation in West Papua. As well as representing Assange and WikiLeaks, she is also named a national pro bono hero by the UK Attorney General. Robinson founded and developed the Bertha Justice Initiative, a program which provides training and work opportunities to early career lawyers in social justice and human rights. The initiative has trained hundreds of young lawyers in 17 different countries. She also founded the Acacia Award in conjunction with the Public Education Foundation in Australia to support children in need and build a network of public school alumni to mentor public school students. She's published several books, including How Many More Women and Silenced Women, Why the Law Fails Women and How to Fight Back. The work is about the laws around the world that silence women, and it explores the changes needed to ensure that women's freedoms are no longer threatened by the legal systems that are supposed to protect them. Fantastic work, and congratulations to human rights lawyer Jennifer Robinson. Proud public school alumni. Back to you, Jean.
Well, that's a really interesting story, isn't it? But I've got another one. It's about a lady called Julie Rovere, who's been recognised for 40 years of service to public education. And the school that she taught in for 40 years, she is still there helping. And she is a great believer in public education. She absolutely believes in it. You shouldn't be disadvantaged by how much money your parents make or where you go to school, she reckons. For a lot of our kids, it's about breaking a cycle, and education is the way how. It may not be by going through university, but just being able to navigate the world beyond school is so important, and for kids to have the confidence to try different things. In country schools especially, careers education matters so much more because students may not know what's out there. And she, of course, is a country girl herself. She went to a country school, and both of her children went through our great state school of the week. So let's hear about it, shall we?
Thanks, Jean. And this week's great state school of the week is Swan Hill College. And here's the principal's message. Welcome to Swan Hill College. As a rural secondary school located near the majestic Murray River, 350 kilometres northwest of Melbourne, we take great pride in our strong sense of community and commitment to student success. Our college operates across two campuses, the main campus, home to approximately 760 students from years 7 to 12, and our flexible learning options, Flow Campus, which supports 50 students in an alternative learning environment. At Swan Hill College, we offer a broad and diverse curriculum, including VCE, VET and VM pathways. Our dedicated team of 61 teaching and 55 support staff work closely with students to provide high-quality learning experiences. I'm fortunate to be supported by three assistant principals, along with six leading teachers. All of our leadership team are actively involved in teaching and continuously working to enhance staff professional development, ensuring the best possible outcomes for our students. We are proud of the range of programs we provide to support student learning. In Year 7 and 8, our literacy support is embedded within general studies, alongside our hands-on learning program, which engages students who thrive with a practical approach. In mathematics, we implement a problem-solving program complemented by Maths Pathway, an adaptive learning platform that tailors content to individual student needs. Beyond the core curriculum, we offer a broad selection of subjects, including science, technology, physical education, humanities, arts, music, drama, and food studies. These programs build a strong foundation for senior school, where our VCE, VET, and VM offerings provide a range of pathways tailored to student interests. As a registered training organisation, we take pride in delivering quality vocational education to our local community. Student wellbeing is a key focus at Swan Hill College. Our dedicated wellbeing team, led by our mental health worker, provides outstanding support to help students build resilience and develop essential life skills. This is complemented by our careers team, who work closely with students to ensure they are well prepared for their future pathways. Our Flow Campus, located on the Lake Boga side of town, offers a blended learning approach for students who find mainstream education challenging. Here, students engage in VM and VET subjects while developing essential life skills such as cooking, numeracy, literacy, and technology. They even operate a student-run coffee shop, serving the local community while gaining valuable real-world experience. At Swan Hill College, our staff are committed to continuous improvement through best practice development. By analysing student data and identifying individual learning needs, they refine their teaching to ensure every student has the opportunity to thrive. And now some information from the MySchool website. The enrolment is currently 747. And the ICSEA value well below average at 944. What that means is that students in the upper 25% of socio-educational advantage make up 5% of the students at this school. The second quartile of SEA, 14%. The third quartile, that is below average, is 33% of students, and the bottom quartile of socio-educational advantage makes up 47% of students at this school. So a school with many disadvantaged students. 9% have a language background other than English, and 14% of the students are Indigenous. The finances, recurrent grants from the Australian government are $3.4 million and from the Victorian government, $12.5 million. Fees and parental contributions add another $305,000 and other private contributions, another $233,000. And that works out at $21,724 per student. The capital, $360,576 over 3 years. The school has great results, with 71 out of 72 receiving a senior secondary certificate, and the NAPLAN results are fine. Back to you, Jean.
Well, our time is gone, and it's up to me now to just remind you to go to 723 Centre Road, Bentley East, to support our teachers in their industrial action outside the Labor Party Nick Storse's office. And that, of course, is next Thursday, the 21st of May, early in the morning, around 9 o'clock. So now it's up to me to thank our wonderful producer, Dale, and her offsider, Andy, and also Sorrel and Jeff, and remind you that our radiothon's coming up, and you can find out more about us at our website at www.adogs.info. But from all of us here at 3CR, it's bye for now.
Saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he. In Salt Lake City, Joe says I, him standing by my bed. They framed you on a murder charge, says Joe, but I'm dead. Says Joe, but I'm dead. The copper bosses killed you, Joe. They shot you, Joe, says I. Takes more than guns to kill a man, says Joe, I didn't die, says Joe, I didn't die. And standing there as big as life and smiling with his eyes, says Joe, what they can never kill, went on to organize, went on to organize. From San Diego up to Maine, in every mine and mill, where workers strike and organize, it's there you'll find your hill. It's there you'll find your hill. I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he.
Subscriber?
We really need our listeners to subscribe to the station. It helps us remain financially independent and is an important part of our community governance.
It's just $40 concession, $80 waged, $150 for a band or organisation, and $300 solidarity.
Become a 3CR subscriber today.
3CR Radical Radio.
Help us celebrate 50 years. Subscribe.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast. We're almost ready to begin 3CR's annual Radiothon, where we raise funds to stay on air for another year. The dog's target this year is $4,500, so if you're able to pledge anything to help us reach our target, please contact the station. Call 03-9419-8377 during business hours, or go to www.3cr.org.au for more details.